again. I'm going to put another leader on this just to make sure, Jim. This is Mike Smith talking to Jim Rademacher on November 16th, 2009, in his home in Roanoke, Virginia. Let's try this again. Now, sorry about the technical difficulty here. So let me go back to, there's a couple things I'd like to cover again. So your first office was when you were elected in July 46, station representative of Branch 1. Is that correct? I just want to make sure I have this correct.
Right. Yeah.
And then you became a delegate for Detroit and Wayne County. This would be for the Detroit AFL-CIO and for the Wayne County Federation of Labor.
That's correct, yeah.
And then your first job, and let's start here and go over, because the one track, it quit on the last track. So I'd like to start from this point again. So you're elected secretary of Branch 1 in 1949. Mm-hmm. And this was this the moment where they said to you, well, we're going to have a caucus, and you said, what's a caucus?
Yeah. Right.
Well, tell that story again, because you ended up sort of dominating the caucus.
Yeah. I was ambitious, and we had a convention in Miami in 1948, and I went to one of the charter members of Branch 1, Henry Heft, and I asked his advice. I said, how do you get ahead in this union? He said, well, we're going to have a caucus when we get back. I said, what is a caucus? And he told me just to bring down a few friends to the meeting that sets up the slate for the next term. So I did what he suggested. I took down a few friends, my whole station. They were friends. There were 105 people in the caucus. There were 35 from my one station. I had no problem in becoming elected secretary of Branch 1.
Now, at this point, though, Jim, and one of the things I wanted to go back over, so maybe our technical difficulty is fortuitous here. So you asked Henry Heff, what does one do to get ahead?
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, you had made a decision that you wanted to work with the union and you wanted to move ahead?
Let's say facetiously, I no longer want to be the rear end of that donkey.
The donkey you marched in with your friend.
Yeah, I wanted to move ahead in the union. Yeah,
well,
I was ambitious.
Yeah, what was behind your ambition? You obviously made a conscious decision that the union was for you, so to speak. Could you talk a little bit about this?
I had a family to support, and another child on the way, and I was getting nowhere on low postal pay. In those days, when I come back from service, I became a regular at $1,700 a year. And that's not very much money if you got a family. So I was ambitious to move ahead, not necessarily financially, but some kind of activity that keeps me going and can lead me to something, which it did. And eventually, as you know, I became president, and there was a reward there, not only from a personal standpoint, but from a financial standpoint, too. So that's what happened, and one thing led to another, and we'll get into how Doherty helped me. That's very interesting, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
But it boils down to I was ambitious because I had a family, and I wanted to keep moving. I just didn't want to keep carrying mail all my life. Nothing wrong with that, but if I could move ahead, I was going to move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So I chose the union route.
Mm-hmm. So then your first taste of union work was, I mean, the administration of the union was as secretary of Branch 1. And that was for, according to my records, about a year, 1949 to 1950.
Yes. Mm-hmm. 49. I think I was elected in 48. To serve in 49, and then in 50 was the election for president.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you went from, in a fairly fast track from...
Yes, I did.
I mean, before the war and before joining the Navy in 1944, from being a career, a substitute carrier, temporary substitute, the lowest of the low. And within a couple of years, within 4 years, then you're Secretary of Branch One.
Yeah.
And then you decided to run for president of Branch One?
Yes, I did. And when the president was fired by the McCarthy Commission for alleged communist activity, and this man was a Jewish lawyer, and Senator McCarthy was out to get these people, not only lawyers, but also he was anti-Semitic, is that the word?
And what was the name again?
James Nonan, N-O-N-E-N. And we fought, we got every congressman in Michigan, we got two senators involved, the postmaster general involved, but McCarthy said, this is it, he's going to stay fired. So he did, and I ran for election, and I won. And Bill Daugherty, the greatest, installed me, and following the installation, one member come up with a beer in his hand and words in his mouth, and he said, who are you? And I said, you just elected me, you just saw me installed. He said, I didn't vote for you, I voted for your father, who was a letter carrier in Detroit. So I felt a little disappointed at that. I thought I earned the right to be president, but here I am riding in on my father's coattails.
Maybe at this point, you could explain your father is a letter carrier, or was, and then a brother too, I believe.
Yes, my brother joined the Army when he was 17. He lied about his age. He went out to Mount Clemens, and then he was shipped over, and he had the honor of serving as the staff sergeant under General Claire Chennault with the Flying Tigers in China before Hawaii was hit in 1941. Mm-hmm. He was in the Flying Tigers doing business in China before this. So then when he came back from military service, he became a letter carrier. And then my wife's brother, James Rice, was a letter carrier here in Roanoke. And my brother's two sons were letter carriers out in Arizona. My brother's son's wife is a letter carrier today in Arizona. So it's a letter carrier family.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Bill Daugherty. Maybe we could speak about him at this time, that you felt he was the greatest president of the letter carriers.
Yeah. Bill Daugherty was ingenious. He had so many ideas. And when he got in there because of Detroit, and that's the reason I got promoted, I believe, from the beginning, is that he felt he owed Detroit Branch 1 something. We were trying to have the incumbent president retire because he was in his 70s, and we had no restrictions. So we had a referendum that Detroit sponsored that went all over the country, and we won by a few votes, but we won. And the man's name that we wanted to replace was Ed Gaynor. He'd been president for maybe 20 years. And let me show you, I think I already told you the comparison. My father, we started at 65 cents an hour. 16 years later, I was 65 cents an hour. Under Ed Gaynor's administration, nothing was gained financially, nothing. So Branch One circulated the petition, referendum, and we won. And Daugherty took over in 1941 from Gaynor, and immediately we started moving on pay and in other areas. He had ideas. For instance, he sent a state police in Illinois to look for a congressman once to come to Washington to get his discharge petition on the floor of the House. All things like this. He was just a great leader. Mm-hmm. And he was highly respected. He was vice president of the AFL-CIO. And after I was installed, he called one day and he said, would you like to represent us in Puerto Rico? I said, Mr. Doherty, I have never been out of Belle Isle. He said, well, do you want to go or don't you? I said, well, I'll be happy to go. So that started me off. And then he appointed me to a board to put in the health benefit plan with NALC, which is now 60 years old. I was on a committee of three that put that in way back in those days. And then he recommended me for the executive board in 1952. And then I kept going up. Then in 1954, we regionalized, and Doherty was smart enough to put a business agent in each region. He gave me Illinois, which covered Michigan at that time. And then he wanted to take care of a officer in Illinois, so he gave him the job and moved me to the Philadelphia region, operating out of Detroit. And then when I got to Washington, I operated the Atlanta region because we had nobody. So I was business agent in three regions. No other person can say that. No other person would want that. So then Doherty kept moving me up and supporting me all the way to the end. And that's how I became vice president and eventually president.
Would you consider Doherty your mentor then? Did you
yes,
work
absolutely.
Closely with him?
Absolutely, he was. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's step back a bit, because we'll go through some of these times you mentioned again. But so you're elected president of Branch One. You at you're 29.
Mm-hmm. Youngest ever
at Branch One, and then you hold this office for 10 years.
10 years.
But during the course of it, you're also doing other stuff as well.
National office.
Right. So, but how was it in branch president? You had that job for 10 years.
I felt that these letter carriers were not just members, they were part of a family. I arranged with people at Olympic Stadium, Olympia. It's down now, isn't it?
Yeah, Olympia was torn.
I arranged that any empty seats would be given to letter carriers. And I would stand at the door at Olympia Stadium, and letter carriers would come down there with their families and get in free to see the hockey games, the basketball games, filling the seats that were empty. We had theater in the round over there at, I think it's called Southfield Shopping Area, theater in the round. And I did the same thing there with empty seats. Letter carriers filled them. I took care of the people, and that's why I kept getting elected. Not only that, in those days, the only grievances that we were allowed, because there was no union recognition whatsoever, all we were allowed as grievances were, we need straps, we need lockers. Hmm. And this was, when we met with the postmaster once a month, this is all we talked about. If somebody got fired, they were at the mercy of management. There was no appeals procedures at all, nothing. Mm-hmm. Until we finally, through John F. Kennedy, got union recognition.
So during this whole era, you're president from 1950 to 1960, and of course for all letter carriers going back to 1889, there's no official recognition
as
the bargaining agent.
No recognition.
You're just a bit of a club at this point.
It was pathetic, really, because, well, I'll give you this example. When I was station representative at Redford Station, the first case I had, a letter carrier with 25 years of service, it got written up because he misdelivered a letter. The supervisor there, I won't name him, he gave him a week's suspension for misdelivering a letter. Well, having been in service only a few years, and I still respected proper delivery, on the other hand, I thought one mistake in 25 years, they should say, you're sorry, and get on with it. Mm-hmm. Well, he insisted on a 1 week suspension, so I went into him and I said, Mr. So-and-so, do you honestly believe this man should get a week off because he misdelivered a letter? He said, we've got to have good service in this station. I said, is what he did any worse than you did when you ordered the engineer, the maintenance man in this post office to go down in this cellar and burn all the A&P ads at Christmas? Was that any worse? He says, I don't think that man deserves a suspension. And he did. He burned those circulars.
Well, tell me about that. What do you mean burned
the
circulars?
In those days, we had a furnace down the basement. Mm-hmm. And because Christmas mail was so heavy, in comes the A&P circulars. And
which are supposed to be delivered to every home.
They're supposed to be delivered to every home. They were not addressed. And he ordered the maintenance man to throw those things in the furnace. So I had them. Now, another thing he did to show how anti-union these people were, we had a merit system that he filed every 6 months. You were judged on attendance, you were judged on appearance, and so on. Quality of performance, and you were given 50 merits or you were given demerits. If you got demerits, you wouldn't get your pay raise, and the regulars got a pay raise every year for so long. In fact, it was sad. You had to wait 21 years to get the top pay. That's one of the reasons for the strike, which we'll talk about. But where was I?
With the supervisors.
So this supervisor, when I became station representative, on my first writing, he gave me 100%. I never got 100% all the time I was there. I was in 85 and 90. I'm not a perfect carrier. And maybe I didn't dress to suit him, but no, he gave nobody 100%. But when I became station representative, I got 100%. I thought, this is strange. So one day I went down to read my personnel file, and there was a copy of that particular quarter. And it had 85 on there. What he had done is give me a copy that he did not send downtown to try to impress me with the 100s. That didn't impress me, because we had grievances out there all the time until he finally gave in. Now, we'll get into other things, I'm sure, but I want to be sure to tell you that I was ordered fired 3 times. We'll get into that sometime.
Well, ordered fired in this branch?
Yes.
As branch president?
Yes, three times.
Now's the time. Let's hear him.
We had a supervisor at Joyfield Station who was miserable to carriers. A woman called in and said, the wife of this carrier has been rushed to the hospital. Can you get him here? He said, well, she's going to the hospital. She'll be okay. Let him finish his route. So I wrote an article in the branch paper that this man is sadistic. And I got a letter of charges demanding my removal from Postmaster Edward L. Baker because I called this man a sadist. I went over to the same lawyer, Wallace Temple, to prepare my defense. While I'm waiting for him, I looked on the bookshelf. This is an absolute truth. And there was a dictionary. And it was a Funk and Wagnalis dictionary, not Webster. And I turned over to the word sadist. And what do you think it said? And it's in there to this day. Slave driving boss. I said, dear Mr. Baker, this is where I got the information to call him a sadist. I quoted Funk and Wagnalis. Yours very truly, he tore up the charges. Number two. Postmaster General Summerfield was an executive at General Motors in Michigan before he became Postmaster General. So he wanted to be in favor with General Motors, and he ordered a lot of little mailsers, three-wheeled vehicles with batteries. He brought them into Strathmore Station in the winter. These men tried to get across the icy Grand River with a three-wheeled with a battery. You can't do this to people. So I went to the newspaper, the Detroit Times, in business at that time. They had a big headline on the front page, pictures. They ordered them out of there, quick. Summerfield called Baker and said, fire this man. He's got no right to interrupt what we're doing. Baker said, if I fire him, he'll become a martyr. He's in cahoots with the Detroit Times. So he didn't fire me.
What year was that?
I was president.
So do you recall the year?
What year was that?
Yeah.
Yeah, 1954. And the third time, I objected to unaddressed circulars. The Union Resolutions Committee in Cleveland in 1954 had a resolution which they approved that said that they would approve of unaddressed circulars. I got on the floor and I said, you're making postal pack mules out of letter carriers, and I'm opposed to this, and I hope this convention will vote it down. And they did. And Doherty, you whippersnapper. But he loved me anyway. So the next day in the Wall Street Journal on the front page, it says, postal pack mules out. I mentioned this. So then Mr. Baker was told again, this man is interfering with what we're doing, and you've got to remove him. He said, you remove him, I'm not going to remove him. In the beginning, Mr. Baker was rather hard-nosed. He'd only been in office for a month. It was customary for Branch One to give the postmaster a little Christmas gift along with other people. It's just customary. We're not trying to bribe him.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you bribe him if you have no rights?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any rights. So I left it on his porch, a big basket of fruit. And I get home, and about 9 o'clock, I get a phone call that says, come and get this package. I said, you don't understand. It's just a goodwill offering. Just Merry Christmas. He said, no, I don't want it from you. I went down and got it and took it to St. Francis Sissy Boys School. And they loved it. The next year, he was so acquainted with us and appreciated us more. We took him for a boat ride out to a little place to eat out here in St. Clair. And everything turned out fine. He treated everybody out there, and he turned out to be a pretty decent guy. It's all how you handle it, especially if you have no rights.
Mm-hmm.
We had no rights at all. And only until John F. Kennedy came in there did we have a union recognition. And that's mm-hmm. a big story by itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, that you have to use extraordinary means outside of the norm, that is, such as going to the Detroit Times and leaking this information here and
but I became a good friend of the Detroit Times because first of all they're in opposition to any circulars being delivered. They bought the ads in their own paper. I try to maintain good relations with everybody. And I'm very proud that when I left Detroit in 1960, they had a farewell dinner, and every congressman from the lower Michigan and two senators were at that affair for
mm-hmm.
me. And I'll never get over that. I was so humbled. Think, here these people are, they take the time out just for me, you know.
Mm.
But I had tried to maintain good relations. People like Martha Griffiths,
mm-hmm.
people like Soapy Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing to me.
How many members were in your branch?
1,500 at that time.
1,500?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in 1949, Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin come up with the idea of muscular dystrophy. Nobody ever heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted the letter carriers to get involved. And they had a brochure to go to each house.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew what it was. It was something new.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that it would be a good idea for the carriers to deliver them and then have a porch light brigade. 7 o'clock tonight, you're going to turn on your porch light and give the letter carrier the contribution. Mm-hmm. Because the people didn't know what muscular dystrophy was, they'd given it to the letter carrier. You know, they give him a couple bucks. So I went to WXYZ that night and told people, now's the time, turn on your lights. And I drove down Woodard Avenue to my office, the Park Avenue building. I looked down the side streets and see these porch lights on. I start crying. Hmm. I actually start crying to think that people would respond like this, you know. We took in $250,000, which today is nothing to Jerry Lewis, but it led the whole country because of the way we handled it, you know.
No, at that time it was a lot of money.
So then what they do? They name me president of the local branch of the Young Muscular Dystrophy Association.
Sure.
I did that on the side. It didn't take any time for that.
Are there any other accomplishments as president that, you know, are notable during your time as president in Branch 1?
Not in Branch 1. I can't think of any.
So at the same time that you're president of Branch 1, you're starting to branch out. So president of Branch 1 is your main job. But then I see that you're a member of the Letter Carriers Hospitalization Committee.
Three of us.
Yeah, and that was, to tell us about that a bit. That was the first.
Yeah, we never had a health insurance. Everybody had Blue Cross or didn't have anything.
Right, but there was nothing provided for you at this time.
No.
What did you come up with on the hospitalization committee?
Well, we came up with a plan, and we were supported by other organizations, other health organizations, to get us started. And then we had offices in our own building. We had a building at the AFL-CIO. The secretaries had a desk on the first level. Mm-hmm. They didn't even have an office. They were stationed on the first level. That's how bad off we were. And then we finally, 1952, Doherty, once again, got the idea of a new building. And he went beyond that. There's so much to tell you. He formed a retirement center in Florida, which he called NowCrest. It's still there. It's full. For less than $300 a month, a retired letter carrier can stay down in Florida the rest of his life, and they do. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful place down there. That was Doherty's idea. We got the loan for the building from the Teachers Association Union in Mexico, New Mexico, for 4%. They kept wanting to know in recent years, don't you want to pay that up? No, we paid it up in 1982. We paid it up.
It's but this is in 1952 that
we built it.
Yeah.
And then for a while, we didn't get enough interest down there. And meanwhile, the clerks, the Federation of Clerks, built one beside us. They went into bankruptcy and they sold it. We didn't. We just kept plugging away. When Doherty left, the new president, Jerome Keating, was not interested in NowCrest because it was Doherty's project. So he wanted to sell it. I advised him, this is political. You've got people down there representing branches from all over this country. Don't sell it. Let's just subsidize it. Well, he went to somebody and told him about it, and that person had a customer to buy the place. We had to pay that person a big reward for finding a buyer, which we didn't use. We kept it. He also told me, we don't want to be involved in muscular dystrophy.
Hmm.
I don't think it's fair to have one particular charity. I said, well, can I handle it? He said, well, if you want to do it on your own, okay, but don't implicate us. So then I was the representative there, and Jerry Lewis opened up a television in New York where he had his annual telethon, but he only took in $1 million. Today it's over $100 million each mm-hmm. year. 1 year I invited every postal union around the world, to send us a uniform. So every hour on the hour, I would dress up to a different uniform. This is a Norway letter carrier giving you money for muscular dystrophy, a British letter carrier, a German letter carrier, every letter, all of them. Problem was, some of the pants of those guys fit above my ankles, and some of them wouldn't even fit around my waist. But it caused Jerry Lewis to have a little joke on it all. But I maintained it, and today, this year, they gave $2 million. Mm-hmm. It built up. And mm-hmm. we just had a bowl-a-thon for them that Fred Rolando sponsored. And they raised, I don't know how much, for next year. Mm-hmm. So those are things that happened along the way. But when I became an officer in Washington, president, I did become president of the Government Employees Council. And I was a member of some group in New York that wanted clean literature or something. I forget the name of it. But I would be different times they'd have invited me.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, another thing I have listed is the National Sick Benefit Association Board of Directors. Is that an extension of the Hospitalization Committee?
No, we've had since 1900 a life insurance branch. We mm-hmm. have a full-time officer there with a big staff. They're worth probably $1 billion right now. And every letter carrier has a chance to get their life insurance, an annuity or whatever they want. And there's no middleman, no profit, mm-hmm. very reasonable. And I have it myself.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the next step in 1957 is you're a member of the National Association of Letter Carriers Executive Board. However, there's also a little incident in 1957. I don't know if this is before or after you're an executive member, where you sue the Postmaster General over Saturday hours. And the Postmaster General was thinking about wiping out Saturday hours.
Yeah.
And you sued him from your branch.
Yeah, and they ruled that we had no authority to do that.
Mm-hmm. So,
but that made them all the madder. They just hated me. But I didn't become president to just sit there, you know. Mm-hmm. And my people were being affected, and I did what I could.
But this gave you national exposure.
Oh, yeah.
Well, did you get support from the national board on this?
No, they didn't. They didn't want to get involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Is this before you became an executive board member?
No, that was 57. That was, by that time, we were all business agents and also on the executive council. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But let me give you a little anecdote here. My first meeting as a national officer, we had dinner every night of the executive council meetings. We had dinner at the Hamilton Hotel in Washington. And I didn't know the difference. I went up, they had a head table and then they had side tables. I had the first seat beside the head table because I wanted to hear what's going on. So the head of the MBA, the life insurance group, national officer from Omaha, he stood behind me. And Doherty said, "Why are you standing up, George?" He says, "This whippersnapper better find out his place. It's not at the head of the table. He just got on the board. He belongs at the end of the table."
Hmm.
So sheepishly, I walked down to the end of the table, and he sat down in that chair. That was his chair.
No.
I didn't know the difference. Sometimes you learn the hard way.
Yeah. So then, you know, during this period from 57 to 60, actually till 62, you're also field director for Chicago region?
Chicago.
and Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and Atlanta. Not all at once, though.
No.
Why don't you explain a bit to us?
There was a business agent. At that time, they were called a field director. They handle all the grievances without any background, without any rights.
Mm-hmm.
They still tried to handle grievances. You had no one to go to. You were at the mercy of the postmaster. But any grievances that took place in the state of Illinois or the state of Michigan would come to my desk, and I would try to handle them, solve them. And then when Mr. Daugherty wanted to appoint another officer in his own state of Illinois, his name was Edward Benning, then they gave me the job of Philadelphia. So I operated the Philadelphia region, which consisted of Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. Anytime any of those people, all those three big states, had a problem, it would come to my office. And then every now and then I would take a plane or train over to Philadelphia, where the regional headquarters were, and sit down and try to resolve grievances. I'd do that maybe once a month.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't become director of Atlanta until I became a Washington officer, because that was a side job that we couldn't afford another business agent.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, we didn't have the money they have now. When the dues are only $6 a year for capita tax compared to $400, that makes a difference.
Big difference. So we've sort of gotten, you know, you're a member of the executive board, and then you're business agent for a couple years,
mm-hmm.
or field director in the time.
Yeah, but at the same time, you're a member of the executive board, executive council.
Right.
You do your own work home, but you're a member nationally. By doing that, by being a member, you're assigned to meetings around the country to speak, represent the NALC around the country.
Mm-hmm. And then by the time you hit 1960 to 60, but well, again, by all this that we've talked about has all occurred within about a decade.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then in 1960, you get a new position, which is National Assistant Secretary Treasurer.
Washington.
Right. So you're on the executive board in 1960, but you're also National Assistant Secretary Director, and for 2 years, field director for Atlanta. So you've got three jobs during those 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had more than that. I'll tell you about it if you want to get into that.
Sure.
First thing happened. In 1960, John F. Kennedy was campaigning. He kicked off his campaign here in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
At Cadillac Square on Labor Day. That's mm-hmm. the way they used to do it. I met him. We talked about labor management relations. He said he promised Bill Daugherty as soon as he got in that he would have a labor management program, and he did. But a lot of things happened in the meantime. I was running for national office in Washington. He was running for president in Washington. We both had something in common. I have some nice pictures that were taken of him, and you have a copy of one of them. So after that, then I got elected to the Washington office, and they assigned me the first thing that happened that people don't even talk about.
Before we go there, though, you had to run for election to be National Assistant?
Oh, yes.
Secretary Treasurer. Oh, so even the assistants ran?
Oh, yes.
You ran on a slate with the Secretary Treasurer?
Oh, yeah.
I see.
Yeah. But I say this critically because I wasn't used to it. National officers were elected by proxy. We would have a meeting at midnight the day before the election of the convention, and the people with the proxy votes would come in and decide what the slate's going to be, but you take an oath that nobody else will run. I didn't like that because I was always elected here. It's more fun running or getting elected. So after I was elected president, we stopped it. Now, my opponents think they did it, but I made the motion for the executive council, let's put in an amendment that there will be one man, one vote. Well, the opponents then said they did it. Well, whoever, it doesn't matter who did it. I didn't like the idea of a proxy vote. I wanted people to vote for me, not just a few handful of people. I wanted to know I'm wanted. So we put in that, and it didn't do anybody any good for the first 6 years. They were closing in, though. We'll get into all that. But what people don't know and don't remember is that Bill Daugherty was fired. Now you wonder, how can a president be fired? The president of the union, Ed Gaynor, in 1920, was fired by Postmaster General Burleson and told to go home. He operated the union out of his home because Postmaster General would not allow any union people to be off the payroll and have a national office. Mm-hmm. So Gaynor operated from home while Burleson was the Postmaster General. That's how bad it got. But Daugherty wanted Lyndon Johnson as president.
Mm-hmm.
So he signed a full-page ad, along with many other people, supporting Lyndon Johnson.
What year was this?
This 19...
Is this 64?
1960.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
When Kennedy was running.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm surprised that Daugherty did that, but the AFL-CIO preferred Johnson. But Daugherty, a very strict Catholic, and John Kennedy Catholic. I thought they might want him, but he didn't pay attention to that. He wanted to go along with AFL-CIO. So when the Civil Service Commission found out he signed that, they fired him.
Hmm.
Under the Hatch Act, which was then in, it's been changed. You cannot endorse any candidate as a government employee.
Mm-hmm.
They fired him. John F. Kennedy never paid attention to who Daugherty supported, and as soon as he got in office, he told the Civil Service Commission, drop those charges, and they dropped them, quick. And then, as promised, in 1962, John F. Kennedy issued the famous Executive Order 10988, which allowed for union recognition, providing the postal employees voted for a union. You had to have that.
Mm-hmm.
We could not get union recognition until we got rid of dual charters, another very serious subject.
Explain.
There were a lot of black members in the South who had their own branch. As more white members became letter carriers, they wanted their own separate charter. So we had as many as 12 dual charters in the same city.
Based strictly on race.
Absolutely.
They sort
of
like
they worked together side by side, but when they have a meeting, it's not only because they didn't want to meet together, it's they couldn't. The law.
Mm-hmm. Well, much like different drinking fountains and different restrooms.
Yeah. So I was assigned, if we're going to have union recognition, we can't have the dual charters. Go to each of those cities and settle it.
Is this in 1962?
1962.
So you personally
I was assistant secretary.
And you were charged with
go down
handling
and do
this.
Yep.
That's a huge...
The first one was Atlantic City, Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't meet anywhere except a federal building. We walked in there, and then the whites were on the left, the blacks on the right. I said, now close the door. We're not leaving here till you get over there and you get over there. And that's it. If you want the union. If you don't want the union, go. Now, get out. I talked. Told how important it was. We fought hard to get this executive order. We don't want to lose it. We don't want you responsible for us losing it. By midnight, they're together. It's one of the best branches we got today. And it's led by a black man.
It's the Atlanta branch.
Yes, the Atlanta branch.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so easy. The worst one, you wouldn't believe. Baltimore, in my opinion, is north.
Mm-hmm.
They gave me the hardest time of all.
Is that right?
They gave me the hardest time of all. But they had to do it. Because if they want a union, you go along with it. If you don't, forget it.
Kennedy, this was the basis.
Absolutely.
No, you know, you'll get recognition, but made it clear.
Only if you prove it.
Only if you prove you get rid of the dual
90%,
charters.
90%. Mm-hmm. But we had opposition. We had a group called National Alliance of just black people. And they were in competition with us. We were in competition with them. A lot of black carriers preferred them because they represented their one color.
But this is National Alliance, is you're saying, is a competitor to the NALC.
They didn't have many members, but they're still a competitor. And when you're looking for union recognition, then they thought they would go there. But not many left us. So we ended up with better than 90%, and we got the union recognition. But one of the worst, Baltimore was the worst case. Washington, D.C., can you imagine? Two charters. The worst case I had, I won't name the city, but the newspaper got a hold of the idea that I'm coming down there. We met down in the basement, and somebody said...
Basement of the federal building?
No, of a man's house.
Ah.
Somebody said, look out on the lawn. A cross was burning.
Hmm.
They drove me through all the alleys, back ways, to get back to the airport and get out of town quick. So I did. But that was the worst, as far as my personal being was concerned. The worst was Baltimore giving me the hard time. But I tell you, being from Detroit, where the liberal, my letter carrier was a black letter carrier. We had him in for coffee, coke, whatever he wanted, a hot day. He was a good friend. He was George to me. And a little boy, you know, and we loved him. I'm not used to this, but I get off the airplane in Atlanta, I couldn't believe what I saw. Whites only, blacks, a water fountain, black, white. I couldn't believe it. It was an education. And then after seeing that, and then go to the meeting and try to get people together, and the law says you can't get together, it's not their fault.
The state law.
Yeah.
See, that's something that, you know, is sort of lost on a lot of people today, I think. I grew up in the 60s, so I have some memory of protest and student protest, mm-hmm. which is quite a bit removed from what you were doing.
Yeah.
I think people today forget about how that was.
Yeah.
You know, because that had to have been a bit, well, one is you have to worry a little bit about your physical safety at certain points. Yeah. And just the different cultures trying to pull them together. But so you were the point person for the whole letter carriers.
I had to go. Yep, I had to do it.
Well, this couldn't have hurt your reputation nationally within the letter carriers.
No, they all knew me then. And when it come time to elect me president, and they knew me. And then in the 62, Bill Daugherty retired. And Lyndon Johnson took over when Kennedy was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And Lyndon Johnson appointed Bill Daugherty ambassador to Jamaica,
mm-hmm.
which is a wonderful appointment. He was the first ambassador to Jamaica.
Hmm.
So.
That's the second union person I know who was a ambassador.
Yeah.
Leonard Woodcock.
Woodcock.
Yeah, right. First ambassador to the People's Republic of China.
China. Oh, yeah. That was a good deal.
Yeah, still, I did not know that a letter carrier president was...
Mm-hmm. So in 62 then, and Daugherty retired, I became vice president. Well, because...
Were you elected vice president?
Yeah. Well, proxies again.
Proxies, right.
I had to be in the chair because Jerome J. Keating, the next president, moved into the presidency because Daugherty stepped back and let Keating run the next election. So then I'm next in line, and I have to ask for nominations. So I said, nomination for president. Guy in the balcony. I should have known better, but I just called on him. He got up first. I nominate Jimmy Rademacher president. I said, oh, gee. Oh, no.
Well?
I look at Keating. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I said, thank you. Thank you for the honor. But I respectfully declined. So then the next motion was Keating, and that was unanimous, and that was it. Well, then in Boston in 68, when I became president, there was no problem, but they were getting a little bit ambitious for recognition for more money and other things. And we'll get into that. That's mm-hmm. when the strike took place. We'll talk about that again. But what's next on the agenda?
Well, tell me about your time as vice president. Now, you say you're elected by proxy, so representatives from different branches vote, not a direct
membership vote. In Michigan, I had the proxy votes for everybody that could not afford to go to the convention. I might have had 200 proxy votes. And it's the same way with all the other officers. Every officer had a lot of support, or he wouldn't be an officer. But I still want somebody to say, I want you.
Direct membership or direct vote.
Yeah. On the other hand, Doherty opposed that. And some of the logic makes sense. The incumbents have the advantage. It would cost $500,000 for anybody to campaign for president next year of this union. $500,000. Once you're in, that's it. You got to get to the membership. And the postage alone, you got to get to everybody's home. So that's the bad thing. The good thing is that every member has a right to vote. They don't do it. We might get might even get 50% if we're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
But you offer them an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I favor that. So there's two ways to look at it. But mm-hmm. when I became vice president, you automatically become editor of the Postal Record.
Ah.
This is when my journalism experience took over. And I tried to do too much. I know that now. But I didn't know it then.
As editor?
Yeah. Well, as president also. I tried to do too much. Today they've got dozens of people walking around headquarters that do all these things. I had nobody. Imagine taking a 100-page convention proceedings, read the proof, and paste it up, and still do the job of vice president. It's tough.
Yeah, that's a lot of work.
I should never have done it. But I had the experience, and you get to feel that you're the only one that can do it. You know. And it's when I retired, a guy gave me a song that Sinatra sent to me, an autographed song. I did it my way, and I did. And as president, you like to do it your way. You like to get advice, but you like to do it your way. That's why you're the president.
That's why you're elected.
That's right. So I did a lot of things my way, and that's where I got caught up when I met with Nixon and didn't communicate properly. A lot of people opposed me, but that's a long story. We'll get into that.
Yeah, let's save that for a little bit. What we've done so far this morning is sort of work up to you being president.
Yeah.
So you're national vice president, and then at the same time, you're editor of the Postal Record.
Yeah.
And then...
Incidentally, while I'm on the record...
Sure.
The Postal Record had the same cover from 1900 until 1945. The same cover. And it was sent to every post office, not to the home. So what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I saw that last month. Don't even bother picking it up. Can't be bothered with it. We didn't get the readership that we should get. When Keating took over, he changed the cover every year, every month, so that people would think it's a nude issue and look at it. And then he decided to mail it to their homes. That's where it belongs. Not in a bundle in a station where you're working. You're not looking at that. You're trying to get over the mail. So that was the thing. And then I was the editor and did the best I could. Today, they've got a regular staff. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot improved over when I had it because it's a regular staff. But one thing about the postal record, I don't know whether I started it or not, we allow everybody to speak out. If they don't like what's going on, they say so, and it's printed in there. You saw that that article you just read.
Mm-hmm.
There might have been a time when they wouldn't print such a thing as that. But they print it. They print any. This is articles in there against Young.
Mm-hmm.
But that's democratic. I mm-hmm. believe in that. If you're afraid of it, well, you know, get out of the business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's another story, that we're democratic. The articles can come in from any branch as long as the scribe is appointed.
Mm-hmm.
And he can write anything he wants, but no foul language. But, and that's good, democratic.
Mm-hmm. So you, during, you know, you're national vice president for 6 years. And then I noticed, though, that you were editor of the Postal Record throughout your presidency as well. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is kind of interesting. You kept control of the main organ.
It's interesting. How would you like to print something that blasted you?
Did you? Did you publish issues blasting yourself?
You're supposed to limit it to 300 words, and my friend Vincent Sombrato insisted on 600 words, and the only thing I could do was print it smaller, the smaller type, and then he blasted me for printing his article smaller type. But I printed it. It was an attack on me constantly, but that's all right. You know, if a carrier has an objection and he doesn't see somebody else objecting, he wonders, what kind of democracy is this? But if you print something that's against you, and the carrier says, oh, they're taking both sides, good. I believe in that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way to go.
Well, let's wrap up national vice president. Were there accomplishments during this era that you're particularly proud of, or battles, or what did it mean to you to be national vice president?
Well, actually, we had no right to negotiate, you know. And actually, the vice president just travels around the country representing the president. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assigned, you know, you answer mail and handle grievances. That's another thing about the NALC, is that if you got a serious grievance in those days before we had Jeff Stewart's and business agents, you would pick a national officer to take a complaint to headquarters and try to settle it, because there wasn't any procedure. You're just at their mercy. So you have to settle things locally, because nationally it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
People were fired and no appeal, nothing. That's why this postal reorganization act is so important, and we'll get into that, how it's so important to the carrier today.
Mm-hmm. So, but at the same time, or shortly after you became national vice president, that's when you also get union recognition from the President of the United States.
From John F. Kennedy.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. In 1962, we got the union recognition. Yeah.
So.
And they had some kind of a tentative agreement, but no final appeal. They set up a board to listen to grievances.
Mm-hmm.
But the board was appointed by the Postmaster General, so what do you get? That's what they tried to do in the Reorganization Act,
mm-hmm.
is let the Postmaster General's board decide your grievances. We've got a binding arbitration. Anyway, why don't we take a bite to eat?